Hey, everybody. It's Trevin McGee from Lawrence.com and Eric Moline from ScenesTealers.com.
I didn't hear the music.
You didn't?
No, I don't. Is it not supposed to be in my headphones?
No.
That's the Scene Stealers theme song as written and performed by J.D. Warnock.
That's true.
Okay. I'll just imagine that I heard it.
All right. Well, it's Friday. Happy Friday, everybody.
And what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to talk about a couple things.
Movies?
Movies, mostly. Good. And the other thing's your drinking problem, because this is an intervention. So.
And that's an awkward thing to experience on a podcast, yeah. On a live podcast.
It's only fair.
It's not really live either.
No.
Okay. So, right. Yeah, what do we got opening this weekend? Hot stuff.
We've got Due Date.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to talk about that here in a second.
Yep.
And over at Liberty Hall, we've got Howl.
Howl.
And I'm going to talk about that because I got to watch it.
Are you under the influence of heat?
No.
Okay.
And then we're going to just talk about a couple movie news things. I'm going to talk about the movie Clifford.
Yes.
You're so happy.
I was happy to make you watch that. I was happy to recommend it and then keep hounding you until you finally saw it.
You can thank Netflix for that one. So, yeah, let's get started. Tell me.
Due Date.
All about Due Date.
All right. So if anybody doesn't know, Due Date is the new movie by the auteur known as Todd Phillips. And you may remember Todd from The Hangover, which was a surprise summer blockbuster just recently. And I believe is the third highest grossing rated R movie of all time and the number one grossing rated R comedy of all time.
Yeah.
For what that's worth. And it stars Zach Galifianakis, who is one of the reasons that The Hangover was funny, and Robert Downey Jr., who everybody knows is funny because they saw Tropic Thunder. And I'm sorry, but that was one of the most amazing performances I've seen in recent memory. Even though that movie wasn't perfect, I think that Downey Jr. was really, really funny in it.
Yeah.
It's kind of alarming that with talent like that, Due Date is so incredibly unfunny.
Really?
Yes. And I know that this movie was moved. It was originally supposed to come out in July this summer.
Huh.
Big summer comedy. And it got moved to November. And it was kind of like, oh, what the hell's going on? Well, maybe this is what it was. There's like a million writers on this movie, too.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why, because there's almost no...
Is it one of those movies where, like, the trailer has every moment in it that's actually funny or remotely engaging?
Probably. I only remember laughing maybe three or four times in the film, and mostly it was some weird, absurd comment from Galifianakis.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a genuinely funny person, and he's trying to do this. They're on a road trip together, and he's the crazy one, right? So Downey is supposed to be the normal one, but of course, like Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
That's what I kept thinking of every time I saw a trailer.
Yeah,
like, oh, it's Planes, Trains.
He's the neurotic one who has to learn to be less neurotic.
Yeah.
And like John Candy in that movie, Zach Galifianakis is the
fat,
the portly eccentric who just wants to be loved.
Right.
And the similarities really end there, other than the fact that they're on the road together. Because I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is actually one of John Hughes' best movies, and I think that it's John Candy's best performance ever.
Yeah.
And I really, really like that film. And okay, all right, so enough of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's impossible not to compare the two. Due Date is just in itself a collection of situations.
Yeah.
You know, where you have a pet, a dog doing something really nasty, and you know, that's a little funny haha joke. And of course, there's a car wreck, and something happens. You know, where there's probably some baggage problems, and maybe someone loses an ID, and maybe they don't have money, and they're stranded. And I mean, it's just a collection of stuff you've seen a million times before.
Right.
And then they shoehorn people like Jamie Foxx in there, and that poor guy, he's got nothing to do except bring up this dumb subplot that doesn't even make any sense, and Galifianakis keeps harping on for some reason. So it's strange, because I really think they had this idea, you know, from the guy that did Road Trip.
Right.
I mean, he already made a road trip movie 10 years ago. And so now he's making another one, and he got two of the most sought after actors in Hollywood to have a tentpole comedy with, and there's nothing there. And I think that Phillips is really showing that he has a lack of feel for what makes something funny. I think he relies too much on montages, and he just kind of arbitrarily cuts and throws an action scene here and just expects that because that's what people do, it's going to get a laugh. But
yeah,
there's nothing to this movie. All these writers,
he's another one of those directors too, and it's a theme in contemporary comedies that really needs to die. But he depends so much on improvisation to make scenes funny that aren't funny.
Yeah,
and there are actors that their entire careers come from that. I mean, Will Ferrell.
Mm-hmm.
I like Will, and Phillips didn't he do Old School?
Old School.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a great example.
Yeah,
The stuff that Ferrell did and the stuff
mediocre that movie made it funnier.
Funny by a lot of crazy improvisation from Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn.
Right.
And that's it. And that's kind of the same thing with The Hangover. I mean, a lot of the funniest, I didn't like it, but a lot of the funniest moments in it came from Galifianakis and Ken Jeong. And I like him okay. I don't think he's great, but Bradley Cooper even had some, he's proven himself to be a decent improvisational actor, And I really think that's his secret talent, is that he just casts people that are very good at filling scenes regardless of how good the script is.
Yeah.
Because and the only credit I'll really give The Hangover is that it made Zach Galifianakis way more, popular, because I think he'd be dead by now.
I think The Hangover deserves a certain amount of credit for A, having a brilliant premise that everybody can relate to, turning it into this little
mystery.
You've
been roofied before?
Well, you know what I'm saying, where you have a night like no other and you can't remember what happened. Yeah. And so they turned that into an entire movie and they put a mystery on top of it. Where is this guy? And I think that served the plot really well and kept everybody interested. And on the way, you're right, there was a lot of funny actors doing funny things, but there's all these horrible detours like the Mike Tyson thing.
Yeah, and just, they just shoehorned wackiness into that movie. You know what I mean? And he seems to do that in every movie.
He turns up the soundtrack.
Let's chop it all together. Let's do the Rain Man.
Yeah.
Do the Rain Man parody.
So this is Due Date is like The Hangover
without the funny parts.
Well, it's just without any of that that kismet. It's without any of those things just coming together and happening and working out. And I think you're right. I think that's what he relies on.
Yeah.
And this movie, following The Hangover, shows that more than anything else.
That's disappointing. I have to admit, I had a little bit of interest in it, just based on the cast and everything, but that's too bad. Well, you were watching that. I was reviewing Howl, the new movie about Allen Ginsberg, starring James Franco and John Hamm, David Strait there, and I think Mary Louise Parker's in it for about 5 seconds.
How exactly are they in the movie? Like, in what capacity?
Well, here's the thing about Howl is it reminds me, it does two things right away. It instantly reminds me of American History X, and I'll tell you why. Because it is a bad movie filled with good performances. Mm. Like, really, really great performances. I mean, I think American History X is one of the most overrated movies ever made. And but I think Edward Norton's incredible in it. And this is kind of the same thing. I mean, clearly the shortcomings of this movie are solely on the shoulders of the director. Because, the script, if it were constructed the way that it ends up being delivered, because Franco's incredible. And
Franco plays Ginsberg.
Yeah, he plays Ginsberg.
And this is his obscenity trial?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I remember there was a movie
out, it's not a biopic,
recently about his poetry, right?
Right.
Where everybody was reading poems and stuff.
Right.
This is actual...
This is him as Ginsberg, and it uses the obscenity trial. That's sort of the central point that the whole movie revolves around.
Is it preachy?
It's not preachy.
That's good.
In terms of, well, it depends on how you define preachy. It's not preachy as in First Amendment rights or the Beat Generation was the greatest generation or anything. There was a Beat Movement, it was a great movie. Anything like, it's not preachy like that. But to go back to my thing, at the beginning, the second thing it instantly reminds me of is that Todd Haynes is a really good director,
yeah.
And as much as I'm Not There struggled, and I think overall was like a failure.
Ooh,
in a lot of ways. To do what he did with I'm Not There compared to what's done with Howl, it's a great contrast. Like, for people that think that I'm Not There is a just big, you know, pompous waste of time, watch Howl. And then you're like, oh wait, no, this is a pompous waste of time.
See, I thought I'm Not There, the Dylan thing was pompous for sure.
Oh yeah.
Definitely not a waste of time, but you're saying this is both.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I say that because it's really frustrating. Their performances are so good, but they practically go out of their way, they being the director or editor and screenwriter, go out of their way to like stand in the way of those performances. The construction of the movie, it's only 90 minutes long, is very fractured, but not in a good way. You know, like it's.
Is it art for art's sake, or is it because it tells a story?
Is it art for art? No.
Yeah, with the whole fractured story.
No, it's doing it to do it. Yeah, it's art for art's sake, I guess you could say. But even that makes it sound nicer than what it is, because it's wasted time for wasted time's sake. And the other reason is because, you know, they start with the beginning of the poem, and he reads some of it, like, right, in the coffee house, the first time he ever read it in San Francisco. And then it jumps forward. And then jumps backwards, you know, and that's fine. I can handle. We've been watching fractured movies since, I mean, forever.
Yeah,
but especially since Tarantino made it fashionable.
There's this movie again called Citizen Kane.
No,
I don't know
what?
I don't know about if you're aware of that one, but
no. But it's super fractured. But the most frustrating thing about it is when they call back to the poem, there are these horrible, horrible animated segments.
Oh,
that are like, and I'm not talking about cell animation. That would be cool. There's a little bit of cell animation, but most of it's digital, and it's just the
like bad computer animation.
Yeah,
like Hoodwinked, like that movie Hoodwinked.
No, like Money for Nothing. Oh. No,
it's like the Dire Straits video.
It's not really that bad, but it's bad. But it's laughably bad because there are all these phallic images in it, and so there's just like 30 seconds of Franco's Ginsberg impression coupled with, at one point, a car drives down a lonely forest highway where all the trees are penises. And then the camera pans up into the night sky where fireworks shoot out like individual sperm and detonate in the air into smaller firecrack
and
sperm.
And then these big flowers come up and the penis plants penetrate them. And Pink Floyd the Wall and Roger Waters steps out and says,
yeah, I'll go you.
Wow, that does sound bad.
So yeah,
and then Sting's like, money for nothing.
Yeah, right. That's the other thing that's terrible. But no, it was really, really frustrating because like they couple that with the poem, and Franco's reading is good. I mean, the way that he reads it and the drama that surrounds the actual court procedure is very well done. And I guess they took a lot of that from court documents, and it works really well. Like they don't make it dramatic for drama's sake. They don't do anything like that. John Hamm is Ginsberg's defense attorney, and he's great. I mean, it's literally John Hamm and David Strait Theron going back and forth with Bob Balaban, and those scenes are great. And then they use different supporting actors to come in as witnesses at different times. So there's Mary Louise Parker. Jeff Daniels is great. He pops in for another like 5 minutes. Jeff Daniels is great. So there's all these great performances there, and it's just super. It's really disappointing that the movie goes out of its way to make it hard to enjoy them, because it really does. And you know, of course, it doesn't really end. It just kind of fades out. You know, which you come to expect. I mean, I'm Not There did the same thing. And, you know, maybe it's not fair to compare the two movies, but it really feels like Howl goes out of its way to do so. And it's really frustrating. I mean, it's not very skillfully done. I wasn't expecting a biopic, but it's like when your dad says, you know, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of how it feels watching this movie, because I wasn't angry at it or the people that made it. I was just disappointed that they seemed to work so hard against themselves.
Yeah.
Especially with the cast they had. So I'm not there, you know.
So far, we've got a whopping recommendation for two films opening in Lawrence this weekend.
Yeah, don't go.
We didn't see Megamind.
We didn't see Megamind.
Yeah, we can't talk about that. But I think I've seen enough of it on TV for the last month.
Yeah, God, last hour.
Yeah, it's insane the amount of advertising. They probably spent as much as
this whole month has just been on this campaign. Yeah, it's just been campaign ads and Megamind just back and forth. And it was really clever when they made like the Megamind campaign ad because that.
I missed that.
Oh yeah, that didn't make me want to smash my own face off with a hammer. But there is a movie still at Liberty Hall that you want to give a plug.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer it's going to be here. Never Let Me Go. I don't know why we didn't talk about it last week, but I saw it a couple weeks ago, and it's a really fine film. It's this dystopian drama where these kids are growing up in this house in this English countryside, and they never really know exactly why they're where they are. There don't seem to be any parents around or anything like that. There's just the school marms and whatnot. And, there's a love triangle between three of them. It's got Carey Mulligan, who was nominated for Best Actress last year for An Education. Keira Knightley, who's been nominated for Best Actress several times.
Can't close her mouth.
Yeah, and Andrew Garfield, who's going to be the new Spider-Man, who was great in
Social
Red
Network.
Riding. Yeah, he was in The Social Network and the Red Riding trilogy just recently. But it's based on this really popular book, piece of literature that everybody loves. I haven't read called Never Let Me Go. Why are you laughing?
I like that you said it's this really popular book, and then you said it's a piece of literature.
Well, okay, so it's not Jackie Collins.
Right, okay.
And that's how I did. Was that as pompous as it could be to call it literature?
I thought it was a funny distinction to make. It's a popular book. It's also a piece of
literature.
It's
a piece of literature.
I'll have you know it's not the phone book. Yeah. It is, in fact, a book with a narrative.
Yep. I've totally lost my train of thought. That was good, though.
Andrew Garfield,
Red
Riding Trilogy. Popular book about...
Never Let Me Go ends up having all this really strong metaphorical ties to kind of whatever you want to see in it. But it's a really depressing film about these... it is. It's really depressing.
Great.
It's really, really depressing.
Oh, good.
The metaphor that I took away from it was kind of like, if I talk about the metaphor, it kind of ruins. There's really no way to not spoil this film.
Yeah, I had to write a little capsule summary of it, and I knew about it.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it yet, but I knew about it from the book and everything. And
let's just say that
I didn't spoil it.
Yeah, the kids find out what their lives mean.
Yeah,
and
there's a very very like sci-fi kind of.
That's the interesting thing. It's a sci-fi idea, but there's no genre.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to characterize it. Yeah,
because it actually takes place in the past.
Yeah,
but it's interesting because. As these kids figure out what they're supposed to be doing with their lives, there's this kind of sense of inevitability and acceptance that comes with it. And I think that's the big, the interesting thing, though. There's no, isn't The Island or some, Logan's Run. Nobody's fighting back. It's just,
they resolve themselves to their fate and just kind of go through it.
Yeah. And it's affecting. It's not the best movie ever, but it's a good emotional film and a solid movie.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, go see it while it's still here. And you called it. Catfish was in theaters at Southwind for all of a week.
Yes.
Gone. So,
yes.
Way to go.
I called it. Well, yeah. I hope that you took that week to see it. And if not, just watch the 2020 episode and have the entire thing spoiled for you. None of the storytelling.
Or you could wait for it to come out.
Yeah, just wait
DVD,
for it to come out on DVD.
Blu-ray.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Scott Pilgrim's coming out this Tuesday already.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I'm excited. There's like they've been putting up little teasers on their Facebook page and the behind the scenes stuff. Like Edgar Wright narrates all the special effects sequences, and it's really cool to see how they put those together. Like he narrates that entire first fight with the guy with the I can't remember his name, but he's got the hipster vampire girls at the end or demons or whatever. Yeah, he explains how they did that whole thing from. Start to finish, and it's really, really cool. So
cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward.
Would like to see Scott Pilgrim versus the World get nominated for visual effects this year.
I think it deserves it.
I think anybody that does anything original mm-hmm. in this era of similar CG special yeah. effects deserves to be noticed. And so
no, I agree.
I think that would be really cool.
I agree. But, you know, it's going to be like Inception or something.
Well, Inception deserves it, too, for kind of, I think, blending, you know, the real world with the CG yeah. instead of just creating an entire CG world sure. and populating people in it.
Yeah. So, agreed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, before we move on to news, I guess I should go into the other movie I watched this week. And
you do a column called Insomniac Movie Theater.
I do. I do a column for both Lawrence.com and ScenesTealers.com called Insomniac Movie Theater.
Really
and
late.
I stay up really late and I watch bad movies or cult movies. It depends. They can be good. And I write about them in my sleep-deprived state. Sometimes I haven't slept at all, and other times I've had like 2 hours, and other times I fall asleep and wake up and the review's done. I don't know how it happened. And so this week I tackled this movie that's gotten a lot of cult notice, and you'd heard about it and really wanted me to do it.
I've seen a lot of, let's put it this way, a lot of internet buzz among a yeah. certain cult group of movie fans and, yeah. and weirdos. and I've been hearing about Clifford. This movie.
Clifford.
For weeks now, and thought to myself, you know, I could watch this, or
I
could see if Trevin wants to watch it. and I went with the latter.
Yeah, and so. I appreciate it. Asshole. Okay, well.
So, yeah, so the conceit behind Clifford.
Here's the premise of Clifford. The premise of Clifford is that 44-year-old Martin Short, this was done in like 1994. Martin Short was born in 1950, released in 94. That 44-year-old Martin Short could pass as a prepubescent boy. That's the general premise. Clifford is about this kid named Clifford, and oh, he's a rotten apple. And Martin Short plays Clifford, and
he's always getting into trouble.
Oh God, he's a rascal.
It sounds like Dennis the Menace.
Yeah, except a lot worse. And so he's a handful, and his parents are flying to Hawaii. And Clifford wants to go to Dinosaur World in Los Angeles. And his dad's played by, I think it's Richard Kind, the guy from Spin City.
Yeah.
Richard Kind is his dad, and he does a really good job being a crazy person. And so he really wants to go to the Dinosaur World, and he wants to so bad that he knocks a plane out of the sky. So the plane's about to crash, and then they make an emergency landing in Los Angeles. At the same time, Charles Grodin, Clifford's uncle, is trying to convince his fiance Mary Steenburgen that he's ready to settle down and he's good with kids. So the timing's perfect because right as the plane lands, Richard Kind says, "I can't do it. I can't take this kid to Hawaii. I'll call my brother and he'll watch him while I'm gone."
Who knocks the plane out of the sky?
Clifford does.
How does he do that?
He goes to the cockpit to see the pilot. And then when he asked the pilot to land in Los Angeles, the pilot says, "Oh, little boy, we couldn't land in Los Angeles unless there were an emergency." And then he starts hitting buttons and brings the plane out of the sky.
Wow.
Yeah. Also, he has a plastic dinosaur named Stefan that he talks to the uh-huh. whole time. And that leads to some dumb, funny things. So, you know, the whole point of why this movie is such a cult movie is because Martin Short's a little kid.
Right, and Grodin is just Grodin, and he's the driest, funniest guy.
Yeah, God, he's got such a gift for just dry humor, and it's really easy to overlook because he did the Beethoven movies, but man,
Midnight Run, he's so good
in Midnight Run, and he's so good in this, too. And he's even good in the Muppet movies. Like, he's a good villain, and he's a good, just sort of cantankerous jerk. And
so what's the dinner scene? Everyone loves the dinner scene in Clifford. What's the legend? Has it been built up too much?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, because I don't even immediately remember what you're talking about.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, there are a couple of scenes that are pretty funny during the dinner scene, during the whole dinner, but the scene itself, I don't exactly remember. There are some other things that are pretty funny, though. There's a really great scene. I posted it in the blog where the exchange between Martin Short and Charles Grodin, where he's trying to line him out, and their sense of timing is so good. Grodin is just such a good straight man, angry, cantankerous straight man. And so there's this point where he tells Clifford, like, look at me. Look at me like a real boy. Look at me like a human being. Look at me like a human boy for a second. For a second. And there are just all these different expressions where Martin Short is trying to look at him like he thinks a normal person should look at him, and he can't do it. And it sounds really dumb, but to see it in action, it's pretty good.
Well, what surprised me about the movie is there was so much talent involved, because not only do you have Grodin.
Yeah, an SCTV director.
Joe Flaherty's brother.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he did it. Like I said, Steam Virgin's in it.
Dabney Coleman.
Is wow. Yeah, Tim Stack is in it for all of a split second. He doesn't even say anything.
So I'm looking it up on IMDb, and I'm seeing that it's written by two guys who I've never heard of, who've never written anything since.
Yeah, and that's telling. Because unless those are pen names, that's probably why. But here's the other thing about Clifford is it begins really ridiculous. Like it's 2050, and he's an old man priest. Clifford is. Martin Short plays an old man priest at the beginning, and very young Ben Savage tries to escape the Catholic school, and he takes him aside, and then the entire movie's a flashback. So that's the whole premise. Like, that's anytime I watch one of these movies, like North is another good example, where it's like, wait a minute, a series of disconnected flashbacks. This is either a dream or it's just, and it's always like North is a dream. They just cop out of the whole thing at the end. This doesn't cop out, but what it does, it forces a happy ending that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it does some other ridiculous stuff. But there are a couple of funny scenes. It does get really dark because Clifford, like I was joking around earlier, Clifford's not really a rascal. He's a sociopath. And he goes out of his way to make Grodin's life miserable just because Grodin changes it, like doesn't cancel his plans to take him to Dinosaur World, but postpones his plans. Just postpones them just for like a day. And he loses his mind to the point that he gets Grodin arrested on a bomb threat. He convinces Grodin's fiance in the movie that Grodin allowed Clifford to be tied up and molested by bikers.
Nice. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So he just goes off the rails, and it's great. And then they kind of cop out and make it a happy movie at the end and everything. Grodin loses his mind and tortures him and all this stuff. It's pretty funny. But it cops out and goes with this happy, forced, stupid ending at the very end. And
so with the biker episode, it could have been called Clifford Got Fingered?
Yeah, it could have. But, I just kept thinking when I was watching, in the hands of a gifted dark comedy director like Peter Berg, Very Bad Things is just one of my favorite, just dark, pitch black comedies, or To Die For is another kind of movie like that, in a director who's made movies like that, Clifford could have been like legendary in just how vile they took it because even though he was a kid, he's an adult actor. So, like, Grodin beats him up, like, three or four times. Like, he beats him up with a baguette in one scene. And at the end, he straps him into a roller coaster at Dinosaur World. And when he gets through, after he gets through one pass, he cranks the speed up and puts him through again and just keeps cranking it up until the ride breaks down. Someone could have some real fun making a pretend boy's life miserable, but they back away from it. Anyway, it wasn't. I was really hoping that it would just be like one of the worst movies ever, and I could just like rail on it. But it's hard to. It was surprisingly, in terms of like the Insomniac scale of horrible movies, I think my favorite one I've watched is still Tarzan the Ape Man.
Yeah, I just can't believe that you're giving it this tepid of a review with all the things that you've told me about it. It sounds like it's pretty insane.
It's 90 minutes. It is insane, but it was just kind of like. It wasn't that insane, and I think maybe it was just built up for me, and I was disappointed.
Yeah, that was my fault.
The other thing is, like, the production quality is not bad either. That's the other thing that always gets me. Like, if production quality is bad, and then it's coupled with bad story and bad acting, for some reason it just trips a switch in my brain that it makes it funnier to me. Because I picture the people on the set that had to, like, do that every day. Or like Tarzan the Ape Man's a great example, like the crew having to stand there while John Derek directs his wife, like, okay, now these indigenous these indigenous people are going to rub white paint all over your naked body. Okay? All right, how's our light? Are we good? All right, action. Yeah. You know, like, that's just, that's way funnier to me than just sort of Clifford's, like, diabolical premise. But right. this didn't do anything like that hilarious to me. So I wasn't blown away by it.
Fair enough.
So let's move on now. Let's go to movie news.
Movie news. A couple things this week that kind of caught my eye. The first one is this movie that you may or may not have heard about called Tree of Life.
Yeah.
Terrence Malick is the director.
One of my favorite directors.
Days of Heaven, Badlands, The Thin Red Line,
yeah.
The New World. All great movies and really slow movies and contemplative and
pastoral. I think Badlands, there have been several times in my life that I could say Badlands is my favorite movie.
Yeah.
If I had to name one, I love Badlands.
So he hasn't made a movie since The New World. He's actually made more, he's on track to make more in the last 10 years than he's ever made.
Yeah.
But The Tree of Life is this project that he's had for a really long time that he's wanted to get done, and he finished it. Brad Pitt and Sean Penn, of all people, like huge Hollywood stars, are starring in this film, and it was supposed to come out here, by the end of the year. They were trying to get it out for release and for Oscar consideration because this is, if anything, a prestige film because, you know, audiences just aren't going to run to go see a really slow, contemplative movie about life, and that's really what
this
is
about. It
worked
for Benjamin Button.
Yeah, it did. It did work for Benjamin Button. And there you go. So Brad Pitt was in that. But, and I hope this movie is a success, but the news that I have, besides the fact that there was a poster that came out today, which is pretty bland and whatever, but it's coming out in May. It's coming out in May 27th now because the studio had some financial problems.
That's so dumb.
And, I understand counter-programming, and they say that the Oscar field is really crowded next year, but he's already working on another film that he's filming right now.
Yeah, come out in 2016.
Yeah, well, who knows? I don't know. He's a notorious tinkerer.
Yeah.
And he makes, he films like hours and hours worth of stuff and then edits it together and puts the movie together, kind of in the editing room. But Tree of Life, though.
How old is he at this point? Do you even know?
He's got to be in his 60s.
Yeah.
Right? Probably. Badlands was 75.
I thought it was earlier than that.
74, maybe. I could look it up.
Let's not waste time.
I'm excited about The Tree of Life.
Yeah, I am too.
But you're not excited about Sucker Punch.
Oh, yeah. That's my little nugget of movie news, and I think nugget's the appropriate
73 word. Badlands.
73, yeah, okay. Zack Snyder's next movie, Sucker Punch, got its first official trailer today. There was a teaser before, and now there's a full-blown trailer.
Zack Snyder, of course, is the auteur behind Watchmen and 300.
Yeah, and I don't know how anyone else felt about those movies, but I hated both of them.
I didn't hate Watchmen, but it really was frustrating.
I hated Watchmen.
Really?
I hated Watchmen. Hate's a little strong for 300. 300 is exactly what it should have been. I mean, you can't really blame Snyder for 300 because all he does is slow things down. I mean, the things that are wrong with 300, what's wrong with the book, too, and it's just Frank Miller.
Either way, it's a crap movie.
It's a crap movie.
did the Owl movie.
But, yeah, Watchmen is bad because of Zack Snyder.
Right.
Because Watchmen really proved that all he can do is slow things down and make things violent.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't convey any emotion. He couldn't convey realistic human interaction.
His fetish got in the way.
Yeah, his signature style of slowing things down.
Although
and
that Dr. Manhattan
bloody.
Montage was amazing. That section was really good.
You know, and you can owe... Like, that is largely good because it was taken frame for frame from the comic, and there's not any speaking parts during that whole segment.
Philip Glass music and everything. I don't know. It was well done. I don't think he's a hack. I just don't like his tendencies.
Sucker Punch, though? I don't think it's fair to call him a hack.
It's going to play right into those.
Sucker Punch, yeah. Sucker Punch is like, this. It looks like, yeah, he wrote and directed. It's one of the first, might be the first, yeah, it is the first original thing he's ever done. And it looks like the fevered drawings of like a 15-year-old sexually repressed. It looks like one of their notebook.
So it's going to be huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, it literally has the main character, I don't even remember the actress's name. The main character wears like a Catholic schoolgirl outfit and wields a sword and a gun and fights giant samurais.
Is that Emily Browning?
Yeah, sure.
And then you got your Vanessa Hudgens from High School Musicals.
Yeah.
And Abbie Cornish.
Yeah. And John Hamm. Hamm is in it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well.
But he's not in the trailer anywhere, so I don't know. Maybe he's like samurai number four. I don't really know. But
Does this have the same CG background that 300 had?
It looks like 90% CG again, which I have to admit, like, the visuals are the most gripping thing about it. But it's this crazy story that's kind of based. It starts kind of like Cinderella or something, where she has to go to a mental institution and scrub the floors, and she's isolated and everything. They come up with this plan to break out, and then she's got to find these five items inside this world called Sucker Punch, and they will get her released. And the fifth item is a mystery. So she basically has to go into this crazy world where dragons fight helicopters and giant samurai warriors wield miniguns.
Sounds like a comic book fantasy nerd sweat dream.
Yeah. But it's all done by this plucky blonde, you know, waif.
Well,
in a Catholic schoolgirl outfit the whole time.
Right.
And that's the whole premise of the movie. So the new trailer's out. You can watch it on QuickTime.
So all the people that gave Glee a hard time for sexualizing these 20-something actors who are pretending to be high school kids are going to be really excited about Sucker Punch.
Oh, yeah. That'll be great. Because not only are they sexualizing a teenage girl, but she's a teenage, potentially mentally ill girl.
Right.
So it's even better.
Well, you know, if I think movies with high amounts of stylistic craziness like Scott Pilgrim, it really all depends on the story. So I guess it remains to be seen whether Sucker Punch has the story.
I mean, he's a great visual filmmaker.
Yeah.
But
although I'm freaking sick and tired of the CG background with real actors in front of them. If you're going to do something, do it. Go full board. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. And that actually leads right into what I wanted to talk about with Tintin.
Tintin.
The Adventures of Tintin. This is Steven Spielberg's directing this movie based on the comic from, what is it, Norway?
Yeah.
Scandinavian.
It was an animated series for a little while on like HBO.
Oh, really?
Mid-90s, early
90s. But the comic book was really popular, and it's set, you know, somewhere in like the 30s or something, and it's this plucky reporter kid and his trusty dog. And what he's doing, Spielberg's the director, but Peter Jackson's working with him, and it's motion capture. Mm-hmm. So all these people, Simon Pegg, Daniel Craig, Andy Serkis, who played Gollum, Nick Frost, Jamie Bell, all these people are doing the performance capture, and apparently what's happening is Spielberg filmed all that with the live actors, and then Jackson's taking the footage to Weta, and they're putting it all together with the backgrounds and everything. But the stills that they showed today made it look like a full fledged animated film. So I think that really what's happening is they're kind of addressing that issue of the Polar Express. And movies like that where the performance capture left the characters with these dead eyes. And
yeah.
It was just kind of creepy.
Oh, God, they're so creepy.
Yeah, and I think that with this, I think that they're kind of avoiding that. You know, I think they're able to get more of the actors' faces. And obviously, Cameron did a really great job with that in Avatar, whatever you think of the script.
Yeah.
Visually, I think he really pulled off the storytelling.
Yeah, he did.
And
he did. That's like the best. That's the best, like, completely immersive CG I've seen in a movie. I mean, I didn't like the story, but yeah, I mean, whatever you want to say about Avatar, I mean, visually, there's not anything.
It didn't get in the way of the storytelling either.
No, it didn't. That was the best part about it. And he actually came out earlier this week and said 3D director, Hollywood should quit making crap 3D movies. You know?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because if anyone has a vested interest in making any kind of 3D movie, it's the guy who patented most of the process. Yeah.
Well, he's got enough money.
He's got enough money, but I mean, like, they have to pay him every time they do something like that. And so for him to come out and say, you know, quality, not quantity, idiots, that's kind of cool on his part.
Well, he doesn't want to see it, you know, get burnt out because he's going to continue to use it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But Spielberg's directing this. That's going to be coming out next Christmas. Edgar Wright is one of the contributors in the screenplay.
Oh, really?
And Peter Jackson. I mean, the amount of talent involved is huge. And it'll be interesting to see, what kind of a family movie that entire crew can
do. You think that's the direction Spielberg's going to go, is just sort of like collaborative? I mean, some directors you see as they get older, they sort of become isolated and they just almost do all of it themselves.
He's always kind of been like that. I mean, didn't he basically do Poltergeist, even though Tobe Hooper, directed it? Spielberg has his hand in everything. And when you hear him, like, when he's involved as a producer in a film, like on Paranormal Activity, he came up with the ending.
Yeah.
That was him. Like, they filmed an ending that Spielberg suggested. I think he's very collaborative, I think, as a general rule anyway. So,
but I mean, this I would agree with that, but I mean, even the amount of work he's doing here, I mean, that seems to go above and beyond even his normal standard. So, anyway. Well, Tintin, I don't know.
So, yeah, The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn, comes out next year.
Secret of the Unicorn.
Yeah. So, I don't know. That's kind of it. I'm excited. And, maybe we can talk about more. We get a lot of movie news that you and I have been talking about. We just haven't been doing on the podcast. So, we've got a lot of ground to cover. The Avengers is coming out, and it might be pushed back because Marvel wants a lower budget. What the hell were they thinking? They've got a million stars in it and a huge budget. A huge story to tell. They need to have a big budget. Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. I'm still just completely geeked that they put Joss Whedon at the wheel.
And I am too.
Can't believe it. No one does. I mean, his ability to write ensembles. The fact that he's a big nerd. He wrote a run on Astonishing X-Men that's still one of my favorite comic book runs ever.
Yeah.
Couldn't have picked a better guy for that.
Now, let's talk about this though. Marvel, the new Marvel that is the movie studio, is known for interfering in every aspect. Jon Favreau complained recently about Iron Man 2 because they had to throw all this stuff to set up all these other movies.
Did you see the on the Iron Man 2 DVD, Blu-ray, whatever, the deleted scenes? Did you see the original opening? The original opening is Tony Stark throwing up on that plane and being sick, and then Pepper Potts finally just kind of shoving him out of the plane and throwing his helmet after him. I mean, like all those clips we saw from the commercials where she like kisses the helmet and throws it out and then he goes after it. That's how the original opening was. Like it opens on him puking in the Iron Man suit and then being clearly drunk and hung over and she has to like hold him up and walk him to the edge of the thing. And so she's, protesting him doing this. And then finally he straightens up and says something kind of catty to her so that she gets on the defensive. And then he asks for a kiss, and she kisses the helmet and tosses it out, and he goes after it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. That would have been a way better opening. Everybody complains about the opening of the film now.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember a few other instances, but yeah, Marvel does like to kind of poke and prod.
Well, now especially because, they're trying to connect all these narratives. They've got Thor and Captain America, and then that's going to run right into the Avengers. They're going to have another Hulk movie.
Yeah.
Jeremy Renner from the Hurt Locker is playing Hawkeye. That'll be weird. Haven't heard whether Ant-Man is going to be in it or not. But
yeah, there was a rumor that he was going to cast Nathan Fillion as Giant Man, Ant-Man, same guy.
That'd be sweet.
Yeah. Well.
So, yeah. Anyway, there you go.
All right.
Superhero nerdy stuff.
Superhero nerdy stuff. Well, I think we're going to end it on that very low note. this podcast was very... It's a
crap weekend.
It's a downer crap weekend, all right? Like, don't be mad at us on Monday.
If you haven't seen The Social Network, go see it.
Yeah.
That's
don't be mad at me on Monday if you go see Due Date and it sucks.
Yeah.
And we told you it sucked because it, don't be mad at us. We warned you. Yeah. Same with Howl. If you go see Howl because you love Ginsberg, I'm sorry. It's not going to be any better just because you like Ginsberg. You'll probably be more insulted by it, honestly.
Sometimes I have to go see movies that I know are going to be bad because I can't help myself.
Yeah, sometimes so I do that, and it's called Insomniac Movie Theater.
Oh,
and it's every Thursday on Lawrence.com and ScenesTealers.com.
Nice. Okay.
All right. Well,
I'm going to watch Clifford, even though you didn't like it.
Better. It's on Netflix Instant. Watch it if
Sweet.
You want.
Sweet. This podcast is sponsored by Clifford from MGM Pictures.